Hello and welcome to the first session of the Shine Bright and Thrive podcast. My aim of developing this podcast is to help as many people as possible understand what helps and what hinders when they desire change. It's aimed at people who want to up their game, start living their best lives, and to start taking steps to walk taller, shine brighter, and to thrive. Why? Because at some point I wish I'd had easy access to some ideas on what I could do to help myself when I needed that. It took me a long time to find them. How? By interviewing different people with expertise in a variety of areas. I'll ask them to share what's helped or hindered their endeavours and to share with you steps that you can actually start taking today, no matter where you are on your journey. I'll also share aspects of my own journey today and some of the bumps I encountered along the way and how I overcame them, in the hope of signposting your journeys too. I've also worked with individuals and groups for almost 12 years now and have learned much from this also. One thing doesn't work for everyone. Why me? I'm a counsellor specialising in trauma and a coach. I found this career after overcoming my own traumatic childhood experience. Before that, I spent 21 years working in corporate banking. For the last 11 years, I've run groups for adults who were abused in childhood and worked with a variety of adults in one-to-one counselling and coaching. I also work for an EAP, an employee assistance programme, and I've noticed from supporting the helpline that similar topics come up over and over and over again. So I'm keen to share beneficial ideas that may be popular in psychological circles but aren't necessarily out there. It's my hope that by sharing these ideas, you'll be prompted to take positive action to help yourselves. An example, in our culture, we aren't necessarily taught to fully feel or even be able to name feelings we're experiencing, let alone how to process difficulties we experience along the way. Something I'd like to share in this first recording is what I'd like everyone to understand. That an amazing trainer and survivor, Carolyn Spring, helped me to put into succinct words. Basically, when we use harmful ways to relieve distress, such as alcohol, food, self-harm, etc., we literally narrow our window of tolerance and become more vulnerable. However, when we use soothing ways to relieve distress, we literally widen our window of tolerance and improve our resilience. However, a great many adults, like myself years ago, haven't really learned any healthy coping strategies or found the courage to fully feel or understand the far-reaching benefits of that. What people have commonly learned is to avoid, suppress, deny, distract, etc. Please consider your own behaviour. It's easy to distract ourselves or slip into avoidance, keep ourselves busy. However, this doesn't make space for us to heal from the hurts we've experienced. One of the very first things we should do before we even think of exploring our previous experiences is to learn some grounding techniques so we can keep ourselves safe and continue to function in life. One, which I share regularly with clients, is this. Put your body into a strong superhero type shape. Lift up your chest, pull your shoulder blades together, making sure you drop them too so they're not hunched around your ears, and put your chin parallel to the floor. Then look around wherever you are and name five things you can see. Just label them. Then name four different things you can touch, three things you can hear, two things you can smell, and then take one long, slow, deep breath in through your nose and pull it right down to your tummy so your tummy extends on the in-breath. We only breathe like that when we relax, so it can signal to your whole organism that it's safe to relax. Then make it a long, slow, releasing breath out. This gives you a small window of opportunity to move your attention away from the sad or stressy thought and turn your attention to something that feels better. You have the power. Now, I'm not suggesting that you ground every time you encounter an uncomfortable feeling. Feelings are meant to be felt, although it's not always convenient to feel them. I once heard an expression that said, feelings are like children, they never grow up. They also interfere with our communication. So a great thing to do is to look up grounding techniques and find some that work for you. Pushing your left big toe into the ground when you're speaking with someone can also keep you grounded and away from the emotional effects, as this toe connects with right brain to right brain communication that goes on between us. A simple but very effective technique. A further aspect of this is that we can, if we try, choose what we focus on. Joe Dispenza talks very much about the necessity of people learning to control their brain waves, to get into their autonomic nervous system to begin to reprogram, and that we are marvels of adaptability and change, although most of us don't behave this way. Once we've found a grounding technique or two that we know we can rely on to keep ourselves safe, we then want to start making space in our lives to begin exploring what prompts us to feel so deeply. Sometimes it can be a challenge to articulate feelings we've been denying, so if you're struggling, look up some emojis or print off a list of feeling words that you can keep with a pad and pen and that you can use to articulate what you're feeling in the now when you make the space to do so. Writing is fabulous and literally aids processing as it connects two opposing sides in the mind. Language and curiosity are together in one side and feelings reside at the opposite side. It's also a huge act of kindness to ourselves to make time to sit down and write about what's going on internally for us. We need to feel in order to heal. And when we're willing to feel at the very deepest level, a door also opens so that we then also have the capacity to feel the greatest joy and start to notice all kinds of lovely things that were outside of our awareness before. Where to begin? Literally anywhere. The thing about journaling, although you don't need a fancy book and you certainly don't want to write neatly and make sure everything's spelt correctly or spaced neatly, the most important thing about writing or journaling in this sense is authenticity. So if you've had a bad day and you're feeling angry or low, write about it. See where it takes you. Be as judgmental as you wish. The page isn't going to be offended. Writing takes the energy from our experiences and puts details of them onto a page. And it also removes the weight of them from our minds and hearts, meaning you can then at some point reflect on what you wrote and see it more objectively. It can even help you find compassion for yourself, and who doesn't want a bit of that? I appreciate that writing for people who've experienced anything traumatic can be pretty counterintuitive and also daunting. However, my biggest breakthrough was writing a letter, not with any intention of sharing it to the person who abused me. I am not an advocate of writing angry letters and posting them. This is not how we achieve the best outcomes. It's much healthier to truly work through your anger, and then if you still feel the need, write a calmer, more balanced, kinder letter. I know from my own experience that it's all too easy to slip into avoidance or distraction and to inadvertently repeat unhealthy and unhelpful patterns of behaviour. These patterns can be challenging to break. But unless we get in touch with the wounded parts of ourselves, change becomes less likely. I'd like to ban the word can't from the mouths of anyone suffering with their mental health. That isn't to say that some people find some things physically impossible. Although in our culture, I can't is said all too often when we really mean I don't want to, or I'd rather not, or I won't. This brings me on to language and how powerfully it impacts on us. In the groups I run, I do ban use of this word because it disempowers us. Consider saying, I can't, and get into the mood of it, and notice the impact on you physically. When we don't feel great, we kind of sag in the middle, which gives us a physiology that isn't so beneficial. Then contrast this and get in the mood of and say, I won't. And notice how that changes your posture and physiology. It feels better, stronger, and is often more accurate. We can develop unhelpful ideas about ourselves as a result of the challenging experiences we've had. These ideas serve us well and can protect us at the time, but do us a great disservice later in our lives. As an example of this, I grew up with the idea that I was clumsy. I certainly am prone to carelessness at times and sometimes do things in a hurry or carry too much at once, which can cause me injury or disappointment on occasion. So let's consider the difference between these two words. If I'm clumsy, it's innate and I can do nothing about it. However, if I'm careless, I can ask myself, how did the careless thing happen and how can I avoid it happening again? And this can bring a change in behaviour, which can also change our experience in the world. Scientific studies actually show that positive and negative words not only affect us on a deep psychological level, but they also have a significant impact on the outcome of our lives. Negative words, whether spoken, heard or thought, not only cause situational stress but contribute to long-term anxiety. In their jointly written book, Words Can Change Your Brain, Dr. Andrew Newberg, a neuroscientist, and Mark Robert Waldman, a communications expert, state, a single word has the power to influence the expression of genes that regulate physical and emotional stress. Also, according to these two experts in their field, exercising positive thoughts can quite literally change one's reality. If you've got into a negative mindset, one thing you can do with a friend or relative is to set a timer for 1 minute on your phone and then exchange as many positive words as you can until the time is up. It's an easy way to alter your mood. Moods. I personally have the view that we have a responsibility with the energy we take into a room. If something is going on for us internally we haven't had the chance to process yet, let's be adult enough to own that and if necessary shelve it until we can be alone later with a pen and paper. Moods are there for a reason. Their origin may reach far back into your earliest memories. I strongly encourage you to explore the origin. Thich Nhat Hanh was a wise and lovely Buddhist monk and died recently, although I'm a big fan of his work and wisdom. He says that all of our experiences go into our mind store, and sometimes these experiences can pop up unexpectedly into our present. It's then our job to nurture and care for these feelings like a small baby. Notice them, acknowledge them, comfort them. This engages the curious part of the mind and enables us to look deeply into them. He says, go back to yourself and recognize the suffering within you. Embrace the suffering. Be curious to understand the roots, the nature of that ill-being, and then you will know the way to transform it. He also advocates for assertive communication, as do I. An example in his recording, The Art of Mindful Living, which is on YouTube, and this one sticks in my mind, although it may be a little sketchy. I often describe the pattern of assertion saying, I notice the thing that's happened, I feel in a non-pointing way, and I want, which is always a win-win for me and you. However, the example Thich Nhat Hanh gives is much more helpful. He says, what you said just then really hurt me and has prompted me to feel angry. I'd like to process the emotional bomb that's gone off within me and talk to you about it in a few days. Then, no matter how much the person wants to talk about it now, do not take the time to process the anger. Write about it. We say things in anger with far too much emphasis or worse. The buttons inside us that other people press are our responsibility. They have roots in our past experiences, and journaling can help us identify these origins and allows us an opportunity to check whether it serves us well to leave them all unexamined. Around 17 years ago, I suffered with depression as I hadn't acknowledged a trauma I experienced when I was 7. It took me 30 years to acknowledge this, and seeking help, picking up the phone also took a heap of nerve-wracking courage. Some things, however, are better done with company. Margaret Holzer, Olympian and survivor, said it took way more than 35 people to get her through the Olympics. So why in the world would she think she could get over the sexual abuse by herself? And she said, why would I want to? My process of recovery started with a trigger that threw me into a deep depression. A medical procedure helped me reconnect with childhood experiences and threw me into a massive avoidance and withdrawal. I felt overwhelmed and lost, the way I had at the time. And now again, I'd lost my self-esteem. I didn't connect what my older cousin had done to me with the reason for my suffering at the time. Although an art therapy session, which I found so uncomfortable, with big paintbrushes like children use and watercolours, helped me very reluctantly label what had happened. When I was asked what the little black cloud was I'd drawn over my own head, what it represented. I remember wanting the floor to open up, and also around that time feeling afraid, like I would get stuck in the darkness and negativity that had enveloped me, as I had no clue how to find my way back. I used to be the most cheery, positive, optimistic person that I knew, and I really wanted to find my way back to that sunny aspect. I listened to the talking book by the late and very lovely Dr. Susan Jeffers, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, who introduced me to the idea of positive affirmations, amongst other things, and I began using them all the time. I grew up with the idea that I was a disappointment to my father, and as the youngest of five, I always felt in the way or in the spotlight for the wrong reasons, the ripple effect of which was tremendous. I would constantly think that I was in the way or that I'd messed up. And in those days, my language could be much harsher with everyone, not just with myself. The affirmations began in 2005 and paid off around 2 to 3 years later, and literally stopped me in my tracks when the voice that came to me after I'd done something clumsy was actually kind and said, "Be careful, darling girl." A thing about affirmations is that they often don't feel so true to begin with, but I guarantee you they are more true than some of the things we tell ourselves that don't feel so good. The litmus test here is just that. If it doesn't feel good, it isn't true. Affirmations also need to be based in the now, so said as though you are already the thing, e.g. enough, capable, etc. The other positive side effect of this is that when we are truly kind to ourselves, we are also kind to other people and much less likely to tolerate abuse or unkind treatment from others. Wins all around. A strategy shared by Susan Jeffers in that recording, which is also a book, additionally helped me claw my way out of the negative darkness I found myself in. She called it a book of abundance. She said, before you go to sleep, write down at least 50 things you can be grateful for about your day. I remember thinking, 50? I wrote down 3 on that first day, got up, had a shower and cleaned my teeth. I'm honestly not sure I would have done those things, but I was aware I needed to do something I could feel grateful for. An amazing thing happened. The following day, I asked myself, what else can I write? And realised there were many things that I was taking for granted. Nice texts from friends, comfy bed, warm home. It encouraged me to leave the house and see the beautiful blue sky and breathe the fresh air. If you're struggling to find anything positive, maybe you can try it too. I highly recommend her books. She shares many helpful strategies. To overcome my idea of being a disappointment, I booked sessions with a practitioner of EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprogramming. This helped me realise the absolutely enormous impact of our beliefs. I was prompted to do this after a lightbulb moment from a thorough introduction to the topic by the very talented Rachel Wesley, an EMDR practitioner, whom you'll get to hear directly from when I interview her sometime soon. As such, I won't say too much about it now, other than it's a trauma therapy. So if you've experienced past and recent trauma, you're more likely to qualify for help from the NHS, although waiting lists can be long. Here's an example of how our beliefs shape our reality and impact on our lives. The day after EMDR had installed positive ideas to replace the untrue and unhelpful idea I had of being a disappointment, I was stood at the station waiting for the commute train and realised I needed a tissue. I have allergies, so I regularly carry tissues. I looked in my bag and found none. I felt the familiar frustration in myself. I would have to buy poor quality tissues from the station when I had many more luxurious ones at home. Just at that moment, it occurred to me that I should take another look. Ordinarily, I would have begrudgingly but acceptantly acknowledged that I'd messed up once again and would have taken action to remedy the mess before even considering a double check, which would generally lead to a vicious cycle of self-criticism. However, on this occasion, when I checked, I found 4 packets of lovely soft tissues. I have hundreds of similar examples just like this, although I'll share just one more. It took place long ago, pre-Google Maps and pre-EMDR. I had an interview for a school job. I'd stayed at my ex's house the night before, putting the sat-nav in the boot of my car with the address stored in it, ready for the journey in the morning. Although my ex and I would have breakfast together, he would then go back to sleep as I got ready and left for work. I opened the car boot and saw nothing. You guessed it, I'd messed up. So I was forced to wake up my ex, ask him to log into his computer and print off directions for me. I felt dreadful for disturbing him, fostering that all too familiar sense of disappointment in myself and causing my inner critic to be really mean. After the interview, I got the job, I'm pleased to say. I opened the car boot and the sat-nav was right there. I had no idea how I'd missed it. Missing it, however, allowed a vital thing to happen. It allowed the old belief to survive. The reason I'm explaining this to you is to help you understand and hopefully begin to challenge your outdated beliefs. Our minds search for evidence to support our beliefs. Our beliefs can literally blind us and prevent us from seeing what's right under our noses. Many people carry beliefs as I had that simply are not true and no longer serve us well. Please take care with the language you use for yourself, especially to young people. Labels can stick and have severe consequences. Although affirmations really do work, it just takes time and vigilance. I'd like to leave you with the idea that I think was coined by neuroscientist David Eagleman, that anything is possible. When we adopt this idea, it enables us to consider whatever is happening could maybe be seen in a different way. Walk tall, everyone. It feels better and literally alters our physiology in a beneficial way. Thanks for taking time to listen. If you found it helpful, please subscribe, please share it. I'll rate it. Thank you, and bye for now.